All right, so this is Bible 231, and it's Wednesday, March 3rd, and I think practicums have already started this week, and, oh, that's what I wanted to say. So when do we have the next lecture test?
March 10th.
March 10th, which is a week from today. So a week from today is the next lecture test, so it'll be similar to the last one. Maybe a couple more questions, but a lot of the exam figures are important, end of chapter questions are important, so you guys really know what to prepare for over the weekend, right? You can listen to the lectures again if you want to do that. We're not quite done with articulations. We have to finish one joint in particular, and this one is emphasized in your lab as well. But make sure you pay attention to your lab instructor, because your lab instructor might have a different favorite joint. Maybe they're going to pick on the elbow or shoulder or something. All right, but mostly I think they're going to be focused on the knee. So here's the knee. There are a number of tendons and ligaments that work across the knee that stabilize the knee that you have to know, as well as the fibrocartilage inside the knee, which we call menisci. All right, so what is a bone-to-bone connection called? That's a ligament, and we're familiar with that because we've just got done covering bones. But there's also dense regular connective tissue that connects a muscle to a bone. What's that called? Tendon. So a tendon and a ligament are basically the same thing, but they connect two different objects, right? So one's a bone-to-bone connection, one is a bone-to-muscle connection. That's why this thing right here that's connected to the superior margin of the patella, we call that the quadriceps tendon, because on the other end that's been cut right here attaches to what? A muscle or a bone? Muscle, because it's a tendon, and in particular the quadriceps muscle, which we're going to start looking at maybe next week. All right, but here we have the patella, and here is some dense regular connective tissue that attaches the inferior margin of the patella to the tibial tuberosity, and so this is a bone-to-bone connection, so we call that the patellar ligament. All right, but they function together to apply tension to the tibial tuberosity when the quadriceps contracts. Okay, so here we see the femur, and then laterally we have the fibula, medially in the leg we have the tibia. Did I get that right? Make sure that you're familiar with the medial and lateral bones of the leg, right? Make sure you know which one's medial, which one's lateral. So here's the fibula, here's the tibia. And so we're looking at the knee joint. Notice that there are two ligaments that go from the medial part of the epicondyle of the femur to the condyle of the tibia. We call that the tibial collateral ligament. And there's another name for that. Instead of naming the bone right here, which is medial, sometimes this ligament is called the? Okay, but what is the tibia, medial or lateral? Okay, you know what? It is medial. It is medial. So sometimes we call this the medial collateral ligament. All right, so that just goes right on the edge of the knee joint, right? It's the medial edge. There's a corresponding ligament on the lateral edge right here. We call that the fibular collateral ligament, or sometimes people call that the lateral collateral ligament. All right, kind of a tongue twister, but not too bad. All right, so what do these ligaments do? They prevent abduction and adduction at the knee, because the knee should work as what kind of joint? What's the motion that's allowed at the knee? Flexion and extension. Okay? There should be no lateral or medial movement at the knee. That's what we would call, what do we call that? Abduction and adduction. There should be no abduction or adduction at the knee, because the shape of the condyles wouldn't support that kind of motion. So these ligaments prevent adduction and abduction. So let me see if I can figure this one out right here. So the lateral collateral ligament, or the fibular collateral ligament, prevents what? Abduction or adduction?
Abduction.
Okay, moving toward midline, right? Because this would get a lot of tension would be applied if the tibia were to move toward midline, and we would call that what? What's moving to midline called? Adduction. So the lateral collateral ligament prevents adduction or hyperadduction, while the tibial collateral ligament prevents hyperabduction or abduction at the knee, because the knee should move in that particular direction, right? Only flexion and extension. So if your knee is hit from the side, do I have a picture of somebody getting hit from the side? All right, somebody's getting hit from the side. Okay, it's not the lateral collateral ligament that gets damaged when this knee abducts. It is what? The tibial collateral ligament that rips when that happens, right? Because this is the lateral part of the leg. Here's the medial part of the leg. All right, so that's what the collateral ligaments do. All right, there are a couple other important ligaments in the knee that we see right here, and they cross over each other. So hence we call those the cruciate ligaments, right? That's how they're named. There's an anterior one right here that inserts anteriorly on the intercondylar eminence of the tibia. And then there's a posterior cruciate ligament that inserts into the posterior part of the intercondylar eminence, right? That's between the condyles of the tibia right here. And these prevent either protraction or retraction of the leg with respect to the thigh or the femur. Because remember, the knee should be what? Only for flexion and extension. So like the top of your finger shouldn't move anterior or posteriorly. It should only rotate at the knee, right? Shouldn't protract or retract. So the cruciate ligaments prevent protraction and retraction. In particular, this anterior cruciate ligament right here prevents protraction of the knee, and the posterior cruciate ligament prevents what? The retraction at the knee. And if those ligaments get stretched or damaged, right, you can actually pull on somebody's leg and move it forward or posterior while their thigh is stationary. And that just is a sign what? That those cruciate ligaments have been stretched out. And those are very common sports injuries as well. Like for instance, if you get tackled from behind and your leg gets pushed forward while your thigh is held in position, right, then this anterior cruciate ligament is going to break or rip, for instance. Okay. All right, so those are the ligaments that I want you to know, which there are five ligaments and this one tendon. So what's the name of this ligament right here? Yeah, it's a patellar ligament, right? Then anterior cruciate, posterior cruciate. Then you got the two collateral ligaments, right? One is lateral, the other is medial right here. So however you want to memorize that, that's fine. Whether by the name of the bone or know that the fibula is lateral, that's fine. And then one tendon, the tendon of the quadriceps. All right, lastly, something else that stabilizes the joint are the menisci. And they're C-shaped cartilages. And at the top and bottom of the C, they get actually pretty thin. They're pretty thick, right, on their medial margin or lateral margin over here. So they do have a tendency to rip sometimes, but they don't rip in this location usually. They rip where they're relatively thin, right, more at the tips of the C-shaped cartilages or the menisci. All right, so there are two. Here is the medial meniscus, and here is the lateral meniscus. So that's pretty much the whole knee right there. So how can you remember this is the lateral meniscus? Because what is it associated with? I don't see the head of the femur on this particular diagram. But what do you see? Condyle. You see condyles, but how do you know which condyle is medial or lateral if it's not labeled? Okay. So I'm not so interested in right or left. I'm interested in medial or lateral, right? Because this doesn't say left meniscus right here. That says lateral meniscus. How are you going to know which one is medial, which one's lateral? Okay, but how are you going to... Okay, so... The answer then is what? By knowing which bone is lateral, it's either the tibia or the fibula. Tibia or fibula. Which one is lateral? The fibula, right? So you got to practice that somehow. That's just got to be right on the tip of your tongue so that you know, so that you don't mislabel these things. So that means that the tibia is the medial bone, right? All right, so this has got to be the medial meniscus right here. And I suppose during the test, you can palpate your leg and you can feel the tibia. And it's going to be medial. All right, you can feel it as the medial bone. There's no other bone in your leg that's medial to that. And that's your shin bone right there that you can feel. The fibula, on the other hand, you can't really feel because it's embedded in so much muscle that you really can't palpate it. Okay, so who's got a question on the knee right here and these menisci and what the menisci and the ligaments and the stabilizing influences these different ligaments have on the knee? Yes.
Can they wear it?
Sure. Besides ripping, yeah, they can wear down with age. Just like hyaline cartilage can wear down, not quite as fast as hyaline cartilage. Okay, but repetitive use injury can wear down the menisci, like running constantly. Okay, if you run for 50 years, yeah, your menisci probably have taken quite a beating.
Is there anything
to fix that? No. Unfortunately. And even if a meniscus is, well, there might be a circumstance, I'm not really up on the latest technology, but you might be able to get a transplant from a cadaver. Okay, but I think it's easier to have a knee replacement, put a whole prosthesis, than put in a meniscus from a cadaver. But at some point in time, that might be an option for somebody to do that. I'm not really sure. I would have to Google it and see. I think knee replacements are so successful that would be the golden standard that a transplant, I don't know if there would be much interest in a transplant. Because there are problems with transplants. Like, you can always test for hepatitis and HIV, but mistakes are always made. And when you get material from another human, you could assume their disease profile as well, right? You can get hepatitis or AIDS or whatever if the tests aren't done properly. And then you might have to be worried about rejection as well. Though I don't know if a meniscus has many antibodies to worry about, but it might. So you might have to be on immunosuppressants your whole life. So it might be just better to get a whole prosthetic knee than a meniscus. But, for instance, if a meniscus is damaged, right, and maybe the tip of this meniscus is floating around inside the knee, well, it can get wedged in a place where it doesn't belong, and it can lock your knee in position, right? So then you can't use your leg. In which case, that piece of the meniscus has to be removed. And years ago, when a meniscus was damaged, they had a tendency to remove the whole meniscus, and not just this little damaged piece. And they thought, and of course, then somebody's knee would move back and forth. And for a long time, people were thinking, well, that's a really nice surgical procedure. But later on in life, well, what do you think might happen to that knee if that meniscus is gone? Yeah, all this hyaline cartilage, all this articular cartilage would be worn away and degraded, and then somebody would have severe arthritis of the knee. So now, of course, when somebody has a torn meniscus, you try to preserve as much of it as possible and just take out the offending piece. Okay, and that's what medicine is all about, is what? Performing a judgment. What's the best judgment call? How can we help the patient the most? Okay. All right, who's got another question about the knee? Yeah.
I have a question about the ACL. I've seen a lot of women with ACL torn in the
Okay. More common than?
Men or like guys?
You know, that's probably the most common ligament to be torn even in any kind of sport. So it's, I'm not sure exactly what, because of maybe the stopping that somebody does. I'm not really exactly sure, but yeah, probably 90% of the time when you hear of a knee injury, it's an anterior cruciate ligament that's torn. Yeah, but I'm not so sure if there's really a big difference between men or women, tell you the truth. But that would be interesting to know some of those statistics. All right, so that's it for skeletal system. That's it for articulation. So that's the extent of what you have to know for the test a week from today. All right, so don't forget, on the test, it's going to be closed book, no notes, no nothing like that, right? Good pencil and an eraser. How do you know if your eraser is any good? You got to test it, yeah, just like that ping test on the internet. Before you take your internet quizzes, make sure you have a good internet connection. Same thing for filling out a Scantron. Take your pencil, make a mark on a piece of paper, erase it with your eraser, and if it doesn't erase cleanly, what should you do with your eraser? Don't get a new one. First thing you should do is throw out the one you have, which will then motivate you to buy a new one, right? Okay, but don't keep that old one around because you might bring it to the test and then you'll have a smudged up Scantron, right? So make sure your eraser works. And then your either Cypress College picture ID or Fullerton College picture ID. Okay, I will need that. Good, so that's what you need. You don't need a calculator or anything like that. And you need the Scantron. 882E is the best one. The one that is not filled in with a color in the bubbles. Just get a one that has a blank bubbles. That's the best one. All right, so guess what we got to do today? What are we going to move on to today? Oh, I didn't ask you for your homework. All right, your homework. You probably know more about what I got to talk about today than I do. All right, so what are we going to start talking about? Muscle, yeah, muscle. All right, so what kind of tissue is muscle? As I pull up the slides. Yeah, we got a number of different kinds of muscle, but is it like an epithelium or connective tissue, nervous tissue, or what kind of tissue? Yeah, it's a tissue all by itself of the four major kinds, right? All right, so it's a tissue all by itself, muscle tissue. And then you should probably know, how many major kinds of muscle are there? Okay, and somebody already said, yeah, three, and the names are skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, and smooth muscle. Right, all right, so we're going to review some of those things. So I'll repeat myself a little bit as I was pulling up some of these slides right here. What do we got? Chapter 10. Okay, chapter 10. This is good. Okay, so muscle is specialized to contract. And so it has a number of different functions besides contraction. Usually muscle is connected between two bones. And when a muscle contracts, it brings those two bones together via some kind of articulation, which we just looked at. Whoa, what kind of articulation is freely movable? Okay, you should think of it maybe in two ways, by structure and by function. What's the functional classification of a freely movable? Diarthroses, right? It's, remember, SAD, it's the last letter in SAD, diarthrosis, freely movable. Okay, but then by structure, how would you describe the structure of a freely movable joint? Which picture? Yeah, you should think of that synovial, right? Synovial joint with the synovial membrane, articular cartilage, and all that kind of stuff. Right, so I think we're doing pretty good. So movement is really important, but skeletal muscles not only allow you to move, but they prevent you from moving. And we, like right now, you're not really exercising a lot of muscles, but if all the muscles in your body were to relax, what would happen to you? Yeah, your head would bounce off the table, and then it would bounce off the chair, and then it would bounce off the floor, right? So you're using muscles right now just to maintain posture, to keep your head erect and pay attention and sit on the chair. So posture, maintenance of posture is very important as well. Another important function of muscle is joint stabilization. You've seen that some joints have a particular structure, like the knee joint is a hinge joint only. It can't abduct or adduct, shouldn't protract or retract. And one of the major things that stabilizes a joint to make sure that it isn't damaged are the muscles that work across that joint. All right, so your shoulder is nice and healthy as long as you have strong muscles that work across the shoulder. And your elbow is nice and healthy as long as you maintain a nice strong biceps and triceps and forearm muscles, right? That protects that joint. And as a matter of fact, if for whatever reason you damage a joint, right, the only way that you can reinstill some health to that joint is not by working on the cartilage or the shape of the bones that come together, but actually to exercise the muscles that work across the joint. So if you damage your knee, guess what part of the body you have to really work on? It's your thigh, because it's those muscles that work across the knee. Okay, so joint stabilization is very important. And then lastly, what about your body temperature? What's your body temperature right now? Are you at room temperature? No, you're not. You're what? Way above or way below? You're way above. You're at 98 something, right? The room is in the 70s somewhere, right? And you can't become hypothermic because, well, you'd die. Your chemical processes wouldn't work. So to maintain your body temperature, muscles are used to generate heat. So heat generation is an important process that muscles perform. And not necessarily cooling. You don't use muscles to cool your body. What kind of process would you use to cool yourself? sweating, for instance, right? And when you get cold, you will start to shiver, right? And that increases your body temperature. That's skeletal muscle that is contracting. All right, so there's some special functional characteristics that separate muscle tissue from other kinds of tissue. And this is contractility. That means muscle can shorten, right? Muscle is excitable. That means muscle can relax, remain flaccid, right? But you can cause it to contract at a particular time. So muscle is excitable, or it can remain relaxed. Muscle is also extensible. What the heck does extensible mean? It means it can stretch. And that's really important, very important kind of concept because, okay, in terms of my forearm, I can flex my forearm and I can extend my forearm. So in order to flex my forearm, I have to contract the muscles in my anterior arm, namely like the biceps, which causes flexion. But you know what? Flexion cannot occur unless something else happens to the triceps, which is in the posterior compartment. The triceps not only has to relax, but it has to stretch, right? And you can only then extend your arm, not because the triceps is contracting, but because the biceps is stretching as well, right? And some people have problems with extensibility of being able to relax muscles, right? And for instance, that's one of the hallmarks of Parkinson's disease, where somebody has good contraction of their muscles, but they can't relax the antagonistic muscles, and their motion is very rigid, is very difficult as a result. All right, another characteristic of muscle is elasticity, which means that if you stretch a muscle and let it go, what's going to happen to it? It's going to go back to its original length. So all of those are very particular terms and have specific connotations for muscle. And then here are those three kinds of muscles, skeletal, cardiac, and smooth. And you should probably have a picture of what they look like underneath the microscope. All right, so what might be one thing that really stands out in your mind as to how skeletal muscle looks? Skeletal muscle, skeletal muscle. Okay, so what are the three kinds? Skeletal, cardiac. What's cardiac mean? Your heart, all right, and smooth muscle are walls of hollow organs and reproductive tract, for instance. That's where smooth muscle is. And skeletal muscle is what? Is contained in more superficial regions of your body, not deep inside body cavities, right? So skeletal muscle, I don't know, tell me what you can remember about skeletal muscle. Ah, striated, those very prominent striped patterns that you see. Skeletal muscle is very long and narrow. Cardiac muscle has striations on it as well, not quite so prominent, but cardiac muscle is short and it has branches. And then smooth muscle is just really kind of funny looking. It's short, doesn't have striations, and has pointy ends to it. All right, so mostly in this chapter, we're going to talk about skeletal muscle. And even in the next couple chapters is mostly skeletal muscle. Another way of thinking about these three kinds of muscles is that some are under your voluntary control. You can actually cause them to contract by thinking about it. And other kinds of muscle will contract on their own because they're controlled by the autonomic nervous system. They're not controlled by your conscious thought. They're automatically controlled by different parts of your nervous system. So you should be able to break these three categories down into voluntary or involuntary. Okay, which one is voluntary? Which one do you have control over? Yeah, that's the only one, all right? And so cardiac and smooth are automatically controlled or autonomically controlled. And as a matter of fact, guess what the only thing that you have control of in your body? There's only one thing. Out of all the pieces that make up your body, there's only one thing that you actually have control over, and that is skeletal muscle, right? Everything else is controlled by the autonomic nervous system, is taken care of automatically for you. Okay, so let's look at a particular kind of skeletal muscle and maybe some of the connective tissues that make up a skeletal muscle. So here's a pretty good picture, illustration. And we see this muscle going across the elbow, and it's going to be a kind of an anterior muscle. So when that muscle contracts, it's going to cause, flexion, right? So this is flex. So decreasing the angle between two bones, that's flexion. All right, so on either end of the muscle, there's a connective tissue that connects a muscle to a bone, and we see it up over here, muscle to a bone, and that's what we call a tendon, right? All right, so this is a whole big muscle. This would be like the brachioradialis muscle. I don't think you have to really know the name of this muscle, but that's about what it would be like when we really start to study bones. Well, there's a connective tissue sheath that covers the whole muscle organ, right? So a muscle is really an organ because it's got connective tissue, it's got muscle tissue, it's got nerves that go to it. So there are all kinds, all the tissues in the body make up muscle. All right, so here is muscle, the organ like the brachioradialis. The connective tissue that surrounds the whole muscle is called the epimysium. And the epimysium is continuous with the tendon right here. They fuse together so that when this muscle contracts, it can actually pull on the tendon because there's a really nice strong connection between the epimysium and the tendon. All right, but if we look at, so here is the epimysium, that connective tissue sheet. But if we look at a cross-section of this muscle, we see some other structures, right? It's just not all homogeneous. It's not one color. We see various structures. So there are like little bundles that make up the muscle right here. Sometimes we call them bundles, but sometimes we call those fascicles. That's a fascicle. And there's a connective tissue sheath around every fascicle. So here's the connective tissue sheath around every fascicle. And we call that the perimysium. All right, so that when muscle contracts, it pulls on the perimysium, and it pulls on the epimysium, and all of these different connective sheaths are connected to the tendon, so it pulls on the bone very efficiently. But if we look at a fascicle right here, what does it look like on the inside? Do you see other structures inside of a fascicle, or is it all homogeneous? A lot of other structures that make up a fascicle. And in particular, these are the individual muscle cells. But of course, this is not drawn to scale because with the naked eye, you couldn't see a cell, right? But on this illustration, they're drawn big enough so that you can see them. All right, so the building block of a fascicle is a muscle cell. And because muscle cells are long and narrow, we call them fibers, right? So a muscle fiber and a muscle cell are exactly the same kind of thing. All right, so what's the building block of a fascicle? A muscle cell. And what's the building block of a whole muscle organ? Okay, would be a fascicle. So what builds a muscle organ, the building blocks of a muscle organ are fascicles, right? So here we have fascicles, and then to make a fascicle, you need muscle fibers. Now there is some more connective tissue around every muscle fiber. We call that the endomysium, right? So those are the three kinds of connective tissues you got to be aware of. Endomysium around every muscle cell, the perimysium around every fascicle, and then when we put all these fascicles together, they're bound together by another connective tissue we call the epimysium, right? So we've got epi, peri, and endo. And guess what mesium means? It has something to do with muscle, right? Okay. All right, so try to remember these building blocks of a muscle organ, right? All right, but you know what? We're not done describing that muscle cell just yet. All right, so if we look at a muscle cell, like what I see right here, here is a muscle cell, and if we just think of it as a flat structure, what do you see inside this muscle cell right here? Yeah, you see striations or you see stripes. You're familiar with that, but we really didn't tell you what those striations are all about. So we're going to look at that today. All right, the other thing that you notice is that there are many nuclei inside this one muscle cell. What's another name for a muscle cell? A skeletal muscle cell. That's the same as a muscle fiber, right? A muscle fiber because it's really long. And the reason why it's really long is because at one point in time during development, these were little progenitor muscle cells. There were maybe thousands of muscle cells that fused together to be one long muscle fiber. And as a result, all of those nuclei are now part of that new cell that developed from the fusion of all those muscle cells, the early muscle cells. All right, so these striations, we can see a light band and a dark band, and it repeats itself over and over and over and over again from one end of the muscle fiber to the other. And as a matter of fact, if we cut open a muscle cell and look inside, is it homogeneous or do you see structures inside that cell? There's even more structures. So I want you to know the building blocks of the structures that make up a muscle fiber. These tubes right here, okay, are what we call myofibrils. And a myofibril, you should think of as an organelle inside of a muscle fiber or a muscle cell. Okay, what does an organelle do for a cell? Generally speaking, what does an organelle do? Does it do like 1,000 different things or like one, usually a specific thing, like mitochondria, you could tell me, makes ATP, right? Okay, what about Golgi apparatus? This was weeks ago. Packaging and modification, okay? So for a myofibril, guess what its one main function is? It shortens, it contracts. Okay, so a myofibril really is the organelle for contraction. Just like mitochondria is the organelle for making ATP, rough endoplasmic reticulum is the organelle for making proteins, a myofibril is the organelle for contraction or for shortening. All right, and I see, I don't know how many I see right here, but let's say, how many do you see? 30, 40 myofibrils? It almost completely fills up the muscle fiber, but it's got to have some room for nuclei, all right? But there's also got to be some room for mitochondria in there as well to make ATP so that this myofibril can actually shorten. All right, so let's look at this myofibril. So let's zoom into the myofibril. And now, is it homogeneous or do you see more structures still? There's more structures in there, all right? Now we're getting down to the nitty-gritty here. We're almost getting to the end. Okay, so now we're looking pretty much at proteins. So these are really small. You can't really see these with your naked eye at all, right? We see proteins, and these dark lines right here are one kind of protein, and these really thin ones over here are another kind of protein. So if we zoom into this region right here, we can see the dark lines are represented in the diagram right here, and the light-colored lines are right here. And the dark ones are, what color? It kind of looks red to me. Is that red or brown? Red. Reddish brown. Oh, okay. I must be getting better because I was confused. Okay. Reddish brown. These are what we call the thick filaments. And indeed, do they look thick to you?
Yes.
Compared to these blue ones right here are the thin filaments. But they also have another name. We also name the protein that makes up the thick filament. We call that myosin. And the thin filaments are made up of a protein that we call actin, right? So if we look inside a myofibril, we see these filaments right here. We call these myofilaments. And the two main kinds of myofilaments are the thick and the thin, or myosin and actin. And guess what? We're almost done with looking at the structure of a muscle now. We don't have to get much more detailed than that. All right, so these are the important important proteins for contraction. All right, but we see a repeating unit, right? From one end of the muscle cell to the other, we call these striations. Right, here we can see that repeated pattern over and over and over again. And from this little disc right here, think of this as a disc that's going all the way through this myofibril. I see a disc here and a disc here. These are the endpoints for the structural and functional unit of contraction. So if you want to understand how a myofibril contracts, right, we just have to look at this one little area right here, which we call a sarcomere. So anytime you hear that word sarco, you should think of a muscle something having to do with muscle, right? Like in a regular cell, you have endoplasmic reticulum, but in a muscle cell, you've got something called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And in a normal cell, we call this the plasma membrane, but in a muscle cell, we're going to call this the sarcolemma, right? So sarco just has to do with a muscle cell. All right, so what are the two main proteins? Actin and myosin. We got a couple other proteins. Namely, this thing that looks like a spring right here, we call that titin. Titin is important because What can you do with a spring? You can stretch it out and let go. What's going to happen to it? It's going to spring back. What characteristic of muscle can we relate Titan to? What were those characteristics? Yeah, right? We have what? Contractility, excitability, extensibility, right? And elasticity. So Titan is the molecule in there that provides for elasticity, that brings a muscle back to its resting length. So Titan is not important for contraction, for shortening a muscle with power to lift a load. It's more for bringing the muscle back to its original length after that load is removed from it. All right, so that's not really a contractile protein. All right, so sarcomere goes from Z-disc to Z-disc, and these different proteins are anchored within the sarcomere. Here is the M-line, and where do you see that M-line? Probably how it got its name.
Middle.
It's right smack in the middle of the... of the myosin, but it's right smack in the middle of the sarcomere as well, right? It's right smack in the middle of the sarcomere. And, of course, the myosin is kind of right in the middle of the sarcomere as well. All right. What kind of protein, contractile protein, is anchored to the Z-disc on either side? All right, now don't forget I said Titan is not important for contraction. It's more important for elasticity of the muscle. Okay. But what protein is connected to the Z-discs? Yeah, you see actin right here and actin right there. Notice actin doesn't go all the way across the sarcomere. It kind of stops before it gets to the middle. All right, so the Z-discs anchor the actin molecules. This M line right here anchors the myosin molecules. Titan maybe helps stabilize the sarcomere a little bit, but really think of myosin being in the middle, anchored to the M-line, and the Z-discs anchor the actin proteins right here. All right, so the endpoints of a sarcomere are defined by these two Z-discs. So someone might ask you, what's the end of a sarcomere called? You would just say a Z-disc, right? What is the thick protein, the thick myofilament inside a sarcomere? Myosin, right? So actin and myosin are what we call myofilaments, the thick and the thin one, myosin and actin. All right. Now, these sarcomeres line up exactly with each other within a myofibril. All right. So all of these filaments line up exactly, right? All these Z-discs line up exactly within a myofibril. But not only that, but all of the myofibrils line up exactly with their neighbors as well. So that when you look at a nice picture of a muscle fiber, what do you see? A really clear picture of striations. That's because these different bands within neighboring sarcomeres don't overlap. They're exactly on top of each other. They don't interdigitate, right? They're exactly lined up, justified with each other. So it's easy to see these striations. Okay, so we have to know the names of some of these bands. Like I see these bands right here. I see a really dark band right here on that cursor. That corresponds to which one of these myofilaments? Yeah, the thick one, right? Because it blocks a lot of light. So this band right here, where we find the myosin, we call that the A band. And on from one end of a myosin to where it starts up again in another sarcomere, this is what we're going to call the I band. So you see the I band from tip to tip of a myosin and a dark band from tip to tip, including the myosin right here. And that's actually pretty easy to remember. I'll tell you the trick. This is not the reason why it was named. It was A band and I band were named because of the properties of polarized light when it was shined through a muscle. All right? That's not important for this class, but I do want you to know A and I. So if we were to look at the A band right here, does it look dark or light? And what kind of vowel do you have in dark? What's a vowel? You have an A, right? A and dark, right? So that matches up to the dark band right here. So we call that the A band. So it's easy to remember. All right, now what about I band right here? It's light. And what kind of vowel do you have in the word light? You've got an I. So you guys shouldn't miss that ever on a test. Even if you got to take it on a board exam in 5 or 10 years from now, right, just remember that. That's not going to be hard to remember. Okay, So here's the A band or the dark band, here's the I band or the light band. We got some other kinds of zones in here, like this, the M line right here has some specific proteins that anchor the myosin, so that makes this area a little bit darker. All right, so we call this the H zone. All right, and then of course don't forget the Z disc, and that's all the parts of a sarcomere that you have to know. Okay. Let me go back to my little list right here. All right, I think I'm going to continue talking about the sarcomere a little bit and come back to origin and insertion in just a little bit, since I think I'm on a little bit of a roll with this picture right here. Okay? So let's look at this particular picture. All right, so where I have the cursor, what kind of protein is that? That's the myosin or the thick. Here is the actin or the thin one. Okay. When muscle contracts, let's take a look at this picture right here that shows muscle contraction. All right, so what's the structural and functional unit of contraction once again called? Yeah, the structural and functional unit. If you want to know how a whole muscle shortens, there's one element inside of a muscle that you have to know something about in order to explain how the whole muscle fiber contracts, and then you understand how the whole muscle contracts, and that is the sarcomere. All right, what are the endpoints of a sarcomere? Z-disc and Z-disc. All right, so now I want to just look at what's happening between these two Z-discs. You know some of the components already, namely what? Myosin and actin right here. So my question to you would be, when a muscle contracts or when a sarcomere shortens, which one of these proteins actually shorten? Is it the myosin that shortens, or is it the actin that shortens, or maybe it's both that shorten? Let's take a look and see how that works. All right, so here we got myosin, here we got actin, and look at the length of, so here we have a muscle that's relaxed, and here we have a muscle that's contracted. How can you tell that this is a contracted form compared to this one? What do you want to look at? Look at the distance from Z-disc to Z-disc. Notice that length from Z-disc to Z-disc in case number one is what? A lot longer than case number three over here. Do you see that on the slide? Does that sort of make sense? Okay, this distance is a lot shorter. All right, too bad I can't go up there with a ruler and show you. But let's look at the length of a myosin from when the muscle is relaxed compared to when it's contracted. Does anybody get an impression of the change in length of myosin from when it's relaxed to when it's contracted? It stays pretty much the same. Okay, it really doesn't shorten. In your book, take a ruler with a ruler. Put it in on your book. I can't go up there with a ruler on the screen and show you. Okay? And I tell you what, now let's not only look at, so myosin doesn't shorten. When the sarcomere shortens, it stays the same length. But now let's look at actin. So here is the length of actin when the muscle cell is relaxed, and here it is when it's contracted. What can you tell me about the length of actin here? But just the length. Not necessarily the relationship to other proteins. You know what? You're going to have to, well, the distance from Z-disc to Z-disc certainly is shorter, but with a ruler, you should be able to prove to yourself that the length of this actin down over here when the muscle is contracted is the same length as when the muscle is relaxed. All right, it's the same length. So, you know what? Protein shortens when a muscle contracts. It's not the myosin, and it's not the actin. It's neither of those two. So now you might be wondering, well, how on earth does something get shorter if nothing inside the muscle actually gets shorter? All right, so this is what we call the sliding filament model for muscle contraction. All right, so neither myosin or actin contract, but what happens is, right, look at my two little markers right here. I got a green one and a black one. And can either of these markers shorten?
No.
Can I compress these? No, they can't get any shorter, right? But presume the black one is myosin and this green one is actin, right? And so if I put them end to end, right, they got a certain length. But how can I bring my hands closer together without shortening the markers at all. Okay? I can get them to slide over each other, and now look, my hands are a lot closer together. But what about the length of each marker or the length of actin and myosin? They're exactly the same. And then what? We can stretch it back out, and then we can contract it again. We can change the distance between my hands by making actin and myosin slide over each other. So that's what we call the sliding filament mechanism for muscle contraction. And you actually see it on this slide right here. Right? So we see that actin has been pulled to the center of the sarcomere from both Z discs, and now there's just more overlap between actin and myosin. I don't see very much overlap here, but now, look, a lot of overlap. So what do we call this area right here of a sarcomere? This what band is this right here? That's the I band. Okay. What happens to the I bands when a muscle contracts? They almost disappear, right? It gets a lot shorter. They disappear, right? And so that's how they figured out exactly how muscle contracts and which proteins actually shorten. They just notice that this I band, which we see clearly in this micrograph, completely disappears. So that's a pretty good typical kind of question that you see on board exams and things like that. What bands of a sarcomere disappear? You're going to say the I band. All right, but look at this H band right here, which is should be a lightly colored band. Guess what happens to it? It gets darker as well. Because why? You have overlap of both actins and myosin in this area, so it becomes very dark. Okay. So now when a muscle's contracted, basically you just have, right, just an A band. So the A band doesn't go away. So what really shortens when a muscle contracts? What are three things that shorten when a muscle contracts? The distance from Z to Z gets shorter. What do we call that? What do we call that structure from Z to Z? That's a sarcomere, right? So when a muscle contracts, the sarcomere gets shorter. But what else gets shorter or disappears? The I band disappears, as well as the? Yeah, that H-band disappears. So those three things actually go away when a muscle contracts. And the only way to explain that evidence using these microscope pictures is what? The sliding of those filaments over each other. That's how a muscle contracts. Oh, what do we call that? Theory. It's been actually proved now. Sliding filament theory. Sliding filament theory. That's how a muscle contracts. And not just that one sarcomere, but all of those thousands or tens of thousands of sarcomeres that go from one end of the muscle fiber to the other and throughout the whole myofibril and even all the neighboring myofibrils within a muscle fiber are doing the same thing, and that can generate a tremendous amount of force. All right, let me go back to talking about some gross anatomy of a muscle, and we're going to continue with that sliding filament theory just a little bit. All right, so there are basically two ends of a muscle. Let me go back to a muscle. Where's the muscle? Here's a pretty good example of a muscle. All right, and this one here kind of looks like the brachialis muscle to me. All right, so here are two ends of a muscle on this brachialis. And when this muscle contracts, guess what's going to happen to the forearm? Okay, stretch is pretty good, but let's talk in terms of some good anatomy language that describes motion. Like we can do what? We can rotate, we can abduct, adduct, we can extend, we can dorsiflex, plantar flex. What kind of motion is happening here? Decreasing the angle between those bones? Yeah, that's flexion. Yeah. Yeah, there's got to be a sign-in sheet here today. Here it is right here. Let's start at this end, like usual. Okay. All right, so don't forget, please sign in. All right, so when that muscle contracts, when that brachialis contracts, what part of your body is moving? Is the arm moving or is the forearm moving? Or are they moving the same? Usually, one part of your body moves a whole lot more than the other. The other is stationary. And that's really important. For instance, if you were going to push on something, I know we don't get a lot of snow, but maybe some of you guys go up in the mountains, get your car stuck in the snow, and somebody's got to go outside and push the car to get it going. All right, so who wants to volunteer to go out and push the car? Nobody. Okay, I'm stuck. I'll go do it. All right, so I'm outside the car. I'm pushing on the car. And in order for me to push the car, to get the car moving, to get my arms moving forward, what do you tell me about my feet? Can they be slipping backwards, or do they have to be stationary in order for me to push the car? Yeah, right. If my feet are going to slip when I push on the car, then what's going to happen to the car? The car's not going to move, right? My feet are moving, right? So things will move appropriately only if one end of the muscle is stationary, is glued in place. All right, and so the end of a muscle that doesn't move is called the origin. It's the stationary end of a muscle. And the musculoskeletal system won't work unless you have a clearly defined origin that is stationary for a muscle to pull on. Here is the other end of that muscle. Voltage, right? There's going to be a separation of charge.